Few of these captains of industry bothered to mask their objectives with sophistries about service or greater good to mankind. They wanted profits, and they got profits, and they were generally admired or envied for their success. For decades, most Americans had no desire to place legal restrictions upon the promoters, except the special kinds of promoters like railroad men and who might be doing them special damage. They favored promoters as a whole because they were all promoters at heart. No American was more typical than Mark Twain, who brilliantly satirized the land speculation around Cairo, Illinois in one of his books, and then poured royalties from his books into a speculative investment in a new invention. He, after all, Mark Twain, had all the opportunities of a Rockefeller or a McCormick. If he failed, was it not his own ineptness as a businessman rather than the system which was to blame? So he reasoned. So millions of middle-class and laboring-class Americans reasoned. And to add on to their traditional faith in profits, individualism, and equality and opportunity, they had a shiny new doctrine to explain why some became multimillionaires while most were penniless. This was social Darwinism, a doctrine which Americans eagerly imported from England, where Herbert Spencer, a sort of universal genius, had applied Charles Darwin's biological theory of the survival of the fittest to human affairs. Spencer was applying the law of the jungle to the existing economic system in a manner which made it seem divinely ordained, and the lions and tigers, as you might expect, were delighted. The rabbits, aspiring to grow as big and powerful as the lions, concurred. In the struggles of the period, those of small property opposed those of large property. But on occasion, both groups cooperated against the propertyless. The propertyless, in turn, did not function like the revolutionary proletariat of Europe. And when there were signs of disorder, as in the Haymarket bombing and the Pullman strike in Chicago, those of large and small property alike closed ranks against them. There was great acclaim when President Cleveland called out the troops against the Pullman strikers, and little attention was given to whatever merit there might be in the strikers' case. When those of small property did come to protest, their demand for curbs on monopoly took the form of agitation for trust busting. In other words, they would cage the most ferocious of the lions. The immutable law of the jungle could then go merrily on. Social Darwinism, widely accepted, was apparently a great relief to the conscience of Andrew Carnegie. He wrote, "Light came as in a flood, and all was clear. All is well since all grows better," became my motto, my true source of comfort. At about the same time, the pious Rockefeller expounded in a Sunday school address, "The growth of a large business is merely a survival of the fittest. The American beauty rose can be produced in the splendor and fragrance which bring cheer to its beholder only by sacrificing the early buds which grow up around it. This is not an evil tendency in business. It is merely the working out of a law of nature and a law of God." Both the American beauty rose of American industrial civilization and the sacrificed early buds merit examination. Industrial and technical progress led to the phenomenal growth of American cities. Urbanization in America followed close behind that in Europe. In 1860, New York, with its 800,000 population, not counting Brooklyn, was next to London and Paris. Philadelphia was larger than Berlin. Chicago, by the way, had only 100,000 population. By 1900, New York, including Brooklyn this time, had 2.5 million people, almost as many as Paris, and Chicago, with over 1 million, was larger than all but 5 cities in Europe. While rural population had merely doubled, that of the cities had quadrupled. In 1860, only 1 out of every 6 persons lived in a city of 8,000 or over. In 1900, 1 out of every 3, from 1 out of every 6 to 1 out of every 3. Farm boys swarmed into the cities to seek their fortunes. The city served as a safety valve to let off some of the steam of rural discontent. There was and is a continuing legend, disproven by statistics, that the city was a far more wicked place in which to live And around melodeons in this period, people plaintively sang, "Come, boys, I have something to tell you. Come near, I would whisper it low. You are thinking of leaving the homestead. Don't be in a hurry to go. The city has many attractions, but think of the vices and sins. When once in the vortex of fashion, how soon the course downward begins." Well, while some rural lads no doubt wound up on Skid Row, and others merely exchanged rural misery for that of the slums, from these native white Americans came a high percentage of the relatively well-paid skilled workers, foremen, professional men, and businessmen. They formed a large part of the growing American middle class and the labor elite. Menial, unskilled, underpaid jobs went to the immigrants who came in by the millions and jammed into the slums. For those fortunate people who earned good livings, the cities had many advantages, not only technological improvements like inside plumbing and telephones, but by the end of the century, better sanitary regulations and better schools. In the cities, too, there was a flowering of culture heretofore unknown in America and existing in Europe only through the patronage of the state or the noble or the wealthy. The new American princes of industry, assuming all the perquisites of European nobility, took over the role of patronage and endowed universities, hospitals, and symphony orchestras, built libraries, and scoured Europe for art and literary treasures, much of them trash, some the greatest in the world. The first graduate and medical school in America comparable to those in Europe bore the name of a distiller, Johns Hopkins. Countless libraries carried the Carnegie name to a generation which had never heard of the homestead strike. This was the American beauty rose. What of the blighted bud? There was, first of all, waste. The waste that some present-day economic historians blame upon the pioneering age itself rather than upon the system, but which certainly the system did nothing to rectify. There was the waste of natural resources so limitless that they seemed exhaustless and which thus might as well be wasted, it seemed. In the colonial period, wood was so commonplace that the colonists applied to its principal product their common word for trash, lumber. That attitude seemed to persist even though conservationists were raising a considerable clamor well before 1900. In cutting off some of the giant sequoias in the Sierras, lumbermen wasted as much as 90% of the wood, and miners worked hard to set similar records of despoliation. There was the waste of competitive building of far more mills and factories in the boom periods than could operate in a depression when many stood idle or were bought up and destroyed by the monopolists. There was the waste of jerry-built railroads and jerry-built cities and the garish waste of much that was built with large amounts of money, the mansions that existed mainly for conspicuous display, which was another of the perquisites of the new nobility. But above all, there was the waste of human resources, the waste of so many millions of laborers and farmers. As business grew larger, the bargaining power of the individual working man declined, and he found it hard to improve his salary or working conditions, even when these cried out for improvement. In 1886, for example, Illinois coal miners were earning an average of $385 a year. And although prices were roughly only a quarter to a third of what they are now, even on that basis, these scarcely could be considered living wages. At the same time, there were a fortunate few in this state who could eat steak for breakfast and save a large part of their wages, like the foreman of a roller bar mill outside of Chicago, who earned $2,200 per year in 1884. But there were far more who were working as much as 16 hours per day, 7 days a week in Southside sweatshops, sewing trousers for 18 cents a pair, or finishing coats for 4 to 8 cents each. The average skilled worker in an Illinois factory in 1884 earned less than $2.50 per day. All workers, male and female, adult and child, skilled and unskilled, averaged $1.51 per day. And yet the irony of it is, So while the American working man may have suffered from deteriorating job or living conditions, his wages, while low, remained about constant, while prices were slowly decreasing. The worker was not content with these conditions, but he seldom turned to the union as a way out. In 1884, again, only one out of four of the Illinois factory workers belonged to a union, and the percentage of all workers was far smaller. The workers themselves, for reasons I have already suggested, looked upon the unions oftentimes with considerable suspicion. They were reluctant to regard themselves as permanent members of a laboring class. There were small groups among them, like the Black International in Chicago, who were ready to take up the flag of the proletariat, to advocate radicalism and violence. But these were far from representative. Labor movements through American history, down to the Knights of Labor of the 1880s, were marked by a strong interest in middle-class reform, a flirtation with cooperatives of similar schemes, and on the part of the leaders, a reluctance to make use of the strike as a weapon to gain better working conditions. Normally, these movements had thrived in prosperity years and were wrecked by the first depression they encountered. Their only marked similarity to more modern labor movements was a tendency toward political action, and that was most likely to drain off into rather futile third-party movements. In the 90s, a new type of labor movement began to make headway, primarily among skilled workers whose property sense, no less keen than that of their fellow workers, had led them to feel that they had a valuable property in their jobs. Earlier, locomotive engineers, who certainly did not aspire to set up railroads for themselves, had formed one of the conservative and long-lived railroad brotherhoods. Now, a variety of skilled workers in other fields, not including the railroad workers, joined the American Federation of Labor. This was a labor movement patterned in its organization and operation after the trade unions of Europe, but which disavowed the European radicalism. These unionists, holding relatively skilled, high-paid jobs, into which it would be difficult to import strikebreakers, did not aspire to a dictatorship of the proletariat, but only to control their own jobs. They stayed out of politics as a third party, and instead were ready to throw their weight to whichever party would offer them the most. By 1900, they had become respectable and were well embarked as a lasting force in American history, but they had relatively little to offer the large masses of semi-skilled and unskilled American workers. In essence, then, by means of the union, a small and favored part of the working class was ready to fight the disadvantages of industrial monopoly by creating monopoly conditions of their own. Labor monopoly could wrest concessions from industrial monopoly and might even be able to work happily and cooperatively with it. No such solution seemed possible for the farmer. The farmer was a businessman, that is, he was primarily engaged in the production of goods for the market. But because he was so highly individualistic and competitive, he had no control over the market. He would not or could not band together with other farmers to force monopoly conditions and higher prices. And because the government was under the control of the industrialists, he could not get it to introduce or enforce monopoly conditions and prices. The grievances of the farmer were real enough, although he was sometimes rather unrealistic in his failure to place the blame in the right quarters. During the Civil War, he had been fairly content with his lot because he received high prices, even though manufactured goods were more than proportionately higher at that time. He mortgaged his land to purchase more land and machinery, and he looked to the future with unwarranted optimism. The years that followed, from the 70s through the 90s, brought prices that, in general, were ruinously low. The nadir came in 1894, when a bushel of wheat that yielded $1.05 in 1870 brought 49 cents, and in 1896, when the entire cotton crop, which was six times as large as that of 1866, brought $51 million less. The entire cotton crop of 1896, six times larger than that of 66, brought $51 million less. Basically, we can now see the farmer's trouble was that he was overproducing for a world market that was not expanding as rapidly as production. Since he sold the great staples, wheat and meat and cotton, on the world market, the protective tariff was of little use to him. It merely guaranteed that while his agricultural products brought low prices, he would have to pay relatively high prices for manufactured goods.